verses 15 and 16, and talking a lot about Abraham. And so today, if you look at your study sheet, here's a picture in the front there of Abraham, who was told that if he could count all the stars in the sky, such would his descendants be, but he had to walk by faith because he, as of yet, had none. But God would provide Isaac, and then the line of the Christ would continue. And so, we're looking at these verses. To give an example, brothers, even with a man-made covenant, no one annuls it or adds to it once it has been ratified. Now, the promises were made to Abraham and to his offspring. It does not say, and to offsprings, referring to many, but referring to one, and to your offspring, who is Christ. And then verse 17. This is what I mean. The law, which came 430 years afterward, does not annul a covenant previously ratified by God so as to make the promise void. For if the inheritance comes by the law, it no longer comes by promise. But God gave it to Abraham by a promise. That's going to be our whole focus today. So you go back to verse 15. Let us begin in the book of Genesis. So turn to Genesis chapter 3. Now, we're going to walk and skip through Genesis, because I want you to see the line of the Messiah that goes from Genesis, the very beginning, all the way to the very end of Genesis. So, the seed of Abraham, the seed of the woman who will come as the Christ, begins with the first verse, Genesis 3:15. I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your offspring or seed and her offspring or seed. He shall bruise your head, you shall bruise his heel. This is the first promise of the seed of the woman to crush the head of the devil. Now, if I had a diagram here, I would diagram this for you. So he's speaking to the serpent or to the devil. I will put enmity between you, that's the devil, and Eve, the woman, between your offspring, which are the demons, and her offspring, which are the descendants, especially the descendant of the woman. He, that is Christ, will bruise your head. You, that is the devil, will bruise his heel. This is the first promise in the entire Bible of the seed of the woman to come. Jesus is going to bruise or crush the head of the devil, but it will cost him his life. If you stomp on the head of a rattlesnake, you might kill it. But if the fangs get into your heel, it's going to poison you. This is a description of what Jesus did. He crushed the head of the devil, but he had to be pierced on the cross, and the poison of sin came into him. So there's constant war between mankind and the demons, but the ultimate seed who is coming will be the one to crush or bruise the head of the serpent. And so all through the rest of the Bible, the Jews are waiting for who is this seed of Eve, of the woman, who is this one? So now we go to Genesis 12, 1 through 3. Darren, can you read that for us?
Now the Lord said to Abram, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you, and I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed.
So here's the first promise, that he's going to have a great nation, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. This is the first promise of the seed of the offspring who will come from Abraham. Right now he's Abram. Later he'll be renamed Abraham. Then turn to Genesis 22, 1 through 8, after he was willing to sacrifice his son. If Elizabeth can read, or did I skip? Oh, no. Read chapter 22, 1 through 8, Elizabeth.
Yes. After these things, God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham, and he said, here I am. He said, take your son, your only son Isaac, who you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains, of which I shall tell you. So Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, and took two of his young men with him, and his son Isaac. And he cut the wood for the burnt offering, and arose and went to the place of which God had told him. On the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw the place from afar. Then Abraham said to his young men, stay here with the donkey. I and the boy will go over there and worship and come again to you. And Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac his son. And he took in his hand the fire and the knife. So they went both of them together. And Isaac said to his father Abraham, my father. And he said, here I am, my son. He said, behold the fire of the wood, but where is the knife of the burnt offering? Abraham said, God will provide for himself a lamb for a burnt offering, my son. So they went both of them together.
And then read verses 15 through 18 to finish this picture, Elizabeth.
And the angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time from heaven and said, by myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this and have not withheld your son, your only son, I will surely bless you, and I will surely multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven, and as the sand that is on the seashore. And your offspring shall possess the gate of his enemies, and in your offspring shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice.
So he was willing to sacrifice Isaac, but the Lord said, I will provide a lamb for the burnt offering. This is a foretelling of Christ. Mount Moriah is right, basically the same place as the Temple Mount, where the temple would be built, and just right beside that was the place of Calvary. So it's saying, you know, I will provide, Abraham is saying, God's going to eventually provide a lamb for the burnt offering. That's a foretelling of Christ. Abraham's about 2000 BC, so this goes way, way back. And then when she read, in your offspring all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, this is what Paul is referring to, the promises to Abraham, his offspring, referring to the offspring that is Christ. Then you jump to chapter 26, 1 through 5. He makes the same promise to Isaac. Who wants to read that for us? Beth, do you have that? 26, 1 through 5.
Now there was a famine in the land, besides the former famine that was in the days of Abraham. And Isaac went to Gerar to Abimelech, king of the Philistines. And the Lord appeared to them and said, do not go down to Egypt. Dwell in the land of which I shall tell you. Sojourn in the land, and I will be with you and will bless you for you and your offspring. I will give these lands, and I will establish the oath that I swore to Abraham your father. I will multiply your offspring the stars in heaven, and will give your offspring all these lands. And in your offspring all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my lands.
Now the same promise is going through his son Isaac. It went from Abraham now to his son Isaac. Then turn to chapter 28, 10 through 15. And now Jacob in verse 10 goes to Beersheba, and he comes to a certain place. In verse 12, he dreams about the ladder set on earth, and the angels were going up and down. The Lord stood above it. in verse 13, I'm the Lord, the God of Abraham, your father, the God of Isaac. The land in which you lie, I will give to your offspring. Here we go. Your offspring shall be like the dust of the earth. You shall spread abroad to the west and to the east, the north and the south. And in you and your offspring shall all the families of the earth be blessed. And so Jacob then awakes from this dream. So now you've gone from Abraham to Isaac to Jacob with the same promise in that seed. And then the culmination of this is in chapter 49. At the end of chapter 49, all through chapter 49, I'm sorry, Jacob is dying. All of his sons come to be blessed by him. Now, if Seth can read for us Genesis 49, 8 through 12, now it's going to go through Judah.
Judah, your brothers shall praise you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons shall bow down before you. Judah is a lion's cub. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He stoops down, he crouched as a lion, and as a lioness, who dare rouse him? The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until tribute comes to him, and to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. Binding his foal to the vine and his donkey's colt to the choice vine, he has washed his garments in wine and his vesture in the blood of grapes. His eyes are darker than wine and his teeth whiter than milk.
So now the promise is going through Judah. Remember why God chose Judah? Judah was the one who offered himself in the place of Benjamin. Remember, they're in Egypt and the Pharaoh, Joseph, who has disguised himself, or he's disguised to his brothers, they don't recognize him. Joseph knows what's going on and says, No, you, I gotta keep Benjamin. You go back and get your father, but I'm keeping Benjamin. And Judah said, No. If we go back to our father Jacob without Benjamin, he will die. Take me, Judah says. If you know the story, that is when Joseph breaks down, doesn't he? That's when he gets all choked up. Push all the Egyptians out of the house. He starts to weep. And the brothers are like, what is going on? They don't know who Joseph is. And he says, I am Joseph, your brother. They were terrified. They're going, oh, no. It can't be Joseph. We threw Joseph in a pit. I am Joseph, your brother. Then he starts to speak to them in Hebrew. And they realize, Joseph is this leader that we've been talking to all along. Because Judah was the one who spoke up and said, I'm going to offer myself on behalf. When Jacob is dying in his old age, God now directs the promises now to go to Judah because he was the intercessor. So verses 8 and 9 is talking about his tribe, his family that will come. He'll be like a lion. But verses 10 through 12, all of that is Christ. The scepter shall not depart from Judah. The scepter goes to a king. That's Jesus. The ruler's staff, tribute, obedience to the people. That's going to Jesus. Verse 11, the foal, the donkey's colt. Remember, Jesus rode a colt into Jerusalem. Jesus is the one who washes his garments in his own blood at Calvary. And verse 18 is just a picture of his beauty. And so now you see how this promise of the seed went from Abraham to Isaac to Jacob to Judah. And then from this point on, because Genesis 49 and 50 are the last two chapters of Genesis, beginning at this point now, all the Jews are waiting for that one to come of the seed of the woman who will crush the head of the devil but will be bruised through Abraham, through Isaac, through Jacob, through Judah. And of course, you know the rest of the story. You know your Old Testament. David and Solomon were of the line of Judah. So by the time you get to Mary and Joseph coming to the house of David, because they were the house and lineage of David, now the Messiah comes forth in the city of David of the line of Judah. So this is what Paul is talking about here. He's talking about the promise to Abraham is to his seed, his offspring. You can call it offspring or you can call it seed. The singular, who is Christ. And so this is really, really important because this is what the whole Bible is about. People can take the Bible and twist it, can't they? To turn it into all kinds of weird teachings. The whole Bible is saying, who is this one who is coming from the seed of the woman through the people of Israel, appears, is proclaimed in the New Testament, and in the book of Revelation, Jesus is called the Lion of Judah, the seed of Abraham, who now is coming, has now come into his kingdom and to his glory. So, this is really, really important. Once you understand this, then you will understand what the rest of the Bible is all about. People that don't understand this pull stuff out of the Bible to teach all kinds of bizarre teachings. So I'll just stop here and see if there's any comments. Before we look at Matthew and Luke, does anybody have a comment about this whole concept of the seed of Abraham? Anybody have a question or a comment? Anybody? So, Darren, while I'm doing this, can you get me a cup of coffee? Kathy and I spent a whole week working on my mom's house. So I had a vacation, but I have sunburn and I'm really tired. I've been painting for 5 days. So every bone in my body, I need some coffee. So, and by the way, put a little cream in it too. Thank you. Sorry, Darren. I appreciate it. How many of you saw the movie Mel Gibson made called The Passion of the Christ? Remember that? That was, what, 20 years ago? Long time. Okay. Do you remember Mel Gibson, who is an exceedingly devout Roman Catholic? If you know about, he even wants to do the Mass in Latin. He's kind of a strange guy, but he is a devoted Roman Catholic. He understood this promise. If you remember the beginning of the movie, the beginning of the movie of The Passion of the Christ, Jesus is praying in the Garden of Gethsemane. His sweat is like coming like blood. And there's this really creepy figure who is the devil, kind of walking through looking at him. They got like the creepiest looking actor in Hollywood to do this. This guy is creepy looking. He's walking through there. Then all of a sudden, Jesus at the rock where he's praying, the camera goes down to his foot and he stomps on the head of a snake. There's a snake coming through the garden. He goes, wham! And that's how the movie began. So Mel Gibson was saying, when we're looking at this movie of The Passion of the Christ, we're going to begin with Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. We're going to begin with this promise, because Gibson understood that all the way back in Genesis, somebody's going to come and crush the devil with his heel. And so that foot comes down and smashes the head of that snake. And then the rest of the movie begins. I remember when I first watched it, I was in there going, yes! I think people thought I was crazy. Going, yes! That's how you begin a movie. You know, rather than just little baby Jesus in the manger, which is great, you know, rather than turn it into a sentimental, oh, isn't the baby pretty, you know. No, wham, and steps on this snake in blood. And the whole idea is that Jesus would literally be pierced on the cross. I mean, nobody was pierced like Jesus. I mean, not only his heels, both hands, his side, they scourged his back. They put crown of thorns. He was pierced from head to toe. And so I really, really appreciated it. I had never in my life seen a movie about Christ that began that way. That is the only one I have ever seen. And it put the whole rest of it into context. So now the fulfillment of that, if you turn to Matthew 26... You know, that movie's been so long ago now that there's a lot of people who have never seen it. I'm sure you can get on Netflix or YouTube or whatever, probably watch it for free. The scene where he's scourged by the soldiers was, I think, overly gory, but at least it got the point about his suffering. Now, this seed of the offspring is a part of God's covenant, Who's got Matthew 26, 28? Who's got that? Jessica, you have that?
Yeah. I asked her earlier.
Yeah, read 27 and 28.
And he took the cup, and when he'd given thanks, he gave it to the Savior, because it all to you. So this is, is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sin.
Every time Jesus mentions the covenant, he's referring to the covenant with Abraham. So we know that once the covenant was established, then later on with his people, he established circumcision. He established later on, many years later, the whole Passover. But all of this goes back to the covenant made with Abram, who would become Abraham. So even the blood of the covenant in Holy Communion is connected to Jesus being the offspring, the seed of Abraham. Then look at Luke 1:72. Every time you hear the word covenant, just remember Abraham. That's the simplest way to remember that.
Pastor.
Yes.
In the notes in that, on that verse, it says some manuscripts insert new covenant.
Right, because the whole idea is that based upon the original covenant of Abraham, now he's got the new. That's because in the other Gospels, it includes the word new. So sometimes when you have a variant in the Greek, it goes back to the fact that other places in the Gospels calls it the new covenant. The new covenant fulfills the old covenant. So from one standpoint, we say it's not that Abraham's covenant has come to an end, but has come to its fulfillment in the new covenant. Yeah, so Paul is saying that we have the promises of Christ, and Christ says, this is the new covenant in my blood. So that is why in some of the text, it's got new, and some just says the covenant. Because if you look at Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John and compare all of them, some of them have the new covenant. The new covenant doesn't mean that everything is discarded, but rather that it comes to its fulfillment. Same thing in Luke 1:72, to show mercy promised to our fathers to remember his holy covenant. This is Zechariah speaking at the birth of his son John the Baptist, the covenant. Then look at Acts 3:25. Let's see who's got that. Vicki, do you have that?
You are the sons of the prophets and of the covenant that God made with your fathers, saying to Abraham, and in your offspring shall all the families of the earth be blessed.
Then God, having raised up a servant, sent him to you first. The apostles are constantly quoting that verse, that Jesus is the one offspring of Abraham in whom all the earth shall be blessed. The Jews should have realized right away that included the Gentiles. He doesn't say only the Jews shall be blessed. All the families of the earth shall be blessed. It took the Jewish Christians a long time to grasp that also meant the Gentiles. Because they were trying to look at it as, you know, Jesus just belongs to us. And then in Acts 7, verse 8, he gave him the covenant of circumcision. So Abraham became the father of Isaac and circumcised him on the eighth day. And Isaac became the father of Jacob and Jacob of the 12 patriarchs. So again, that's the line of the Messiah and the covenant and the promise. Then took a look at Romans 4 verse 13. One extra little addendum to this discussion of the covenant through Abraham. Once the seed of Abraham has come, Jesus, and now that he brings Jews and Gentiles into the church, the book of Romans explains in Romans 8 through 10 that the new Israel now is the church, the people made up of Jews and Gentiles who are the church. That's extremely important because our evangelical friends misuse that passage and think it's still a promise to this nation, these people living over in Palestine, when in reality, the new Israel now is the church. So by the way, when we're singing the Psalms that help you, oh, bless Israel, O Lord, Israel praises you. Now in the new covenant, Israel is you and me. It's the church. This is another biggie, isn't it? When people don't grasp that Israel is the church, now they get into all this millennialistic stuff that the nation of Israel has to be rebuilt and Jesus is going to come down and live over in Jerusalem, and we have to support the people of the nation of Israel to bring in the end times. This is called dispensationalism and millennialism. And we have nothing to do with that because that's a complete misunderstanding. Israel is now the church. So now Israel, the church, is the one blessed by God to bring the gospel to all the nations. And so this is an addendum to what we're talking about, the seed of Abraham. Now Romans 4, 13. Doran, do you have that?
Yes. For the promise to Abraham and his offspring that he would be the heir of the world did not come through the law, but through the righteousness of faith.
He had a simple faith that he was willing to sacrifice Isaac. And then, Doran, if you can read Romans 9, 4. And then read verse 5 also. So we should really honor our Jewish friends. We should honor Israel, even though the new Israel now is the church of Jews and Gentiles. Paul was a Jew, and he's saying, I so much want the Israelites to come to faith in their own Messiah. Because look at everything they were given. The adoption, the glory, the covenants, the law, worship, promises, the patriarchs. From their race came Christ. So they were greatly blessed. Now the ramifications that for us is that there should be no anti-Semitism among Christians at all. We should not hate Jews. Our Lord Jesus Christ came from the Jews, right? Jesus is the King of the Jews and the Lord of the Gentile nations. If there's anybody who should not be anti-Semitic, it's Christians. Now unfortunately there are a lot of Christian people for some reason that just don't like Jews. Well, all I gotta say, if you don't like Jews, then I guess you don't like Jesus. Jesus was Jewish. And so we honor that. And he's Romans 9, he's just saying, I wish the Jewish people would realize that Christ is their Messiah. By the way, Jordan Pizer, who was our vicar before Vicar Gashler, got a call out to a church in New Jersey. But he was raised Jewish. His uncles are rabbis. He's also going to be serving the apple of his eye Jewish evangelism ministry, which is really big out in New York because there's lots of Jewish people in New York. So he's going to be serving his church, but the synod is going to utilize him. Excuse me. And I told him at the end of his vicarage last year, I said, you need to call the International Center in St. Louis in the Missouri Synod and get in contact with the man who runs Apple of His Eye Ministry, who was also Jewish and became a Christian. He's a Missouri Synod missionary, and sure enough, he did. And so they're going to utilize him because he can go to people and say, listen, I was raised Jewish, okay? We ate the kosher foods. We celebrated the Passover. My uncles are rabbis. I was circumcised. You know, he was circumcised at 8 days old because he became a Christian when he was a teenager. He is the one that can explain to his Jewish friends. But Christ is our Messiah. So remember, all through the Bible, he came for the Jews first and then the Gentiles. So every single city that Paul went into in the book of Acts, the first place they went to was the synagogue. He wanted to honor his Jewish friends. He went into the synagogue with his fellow Jews. he was circumcised, he could come right in. A Gentile could not come in because they were uncircumcised. And then as the readings were done, he would sit down and say, let me explain to you. I'm bearing witness to you that Jesus is our promised Messiah. Some of the Jewish people would come to faith. Other people would be angry and kick them out of the synagogue. And then their work was done there, at least for a while. And then they would go out to the marketplace and start sharing with the Gentiles. And so we encourage Jewish evangelism as a great, great thing. And that's why there's a group called Jews for Jesus, which is not actually Lutheran, but Jews for Jesus. Their whole focus is bringing the gospel to Jews. And according to Christian Freedom, a lot of these Jews for Jesus people actually have their Christian worship service on a Saturday, just to kind of remove that, at least temporarily, from the equation. Christians normally worship on Sunday in the honor of the Lord's resurrection, but if they want to have services on Saturday, that's fine. So that their Jewish friends can see, you know, we're Jewish like you, but we need to explain to you that Jesus is Messiah. Then 2 Corinthians 3:14. So interesting to see how the Lord's going to use, I think he's ordained now, I'm not sure if he's Pastor Pizer yet, if he's been ordained, how the Lord can use him. And this is the sad reality, 2 Corinthians 3:14. Sharon, do you have that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But their minds were hardened, for to this day, when they read the old covenant, that same veil remains unlifted, because only through Christ is it taken away.
So, just imagine a veil over your face. Now, I know some of you were brides and you had a veil where, you know, you could kind of see through it. But imagine a veil over your face that you can't hardly even see anything through it. They're saying that Jewish people are reading the Old Testament. They're not realizing that Christ is the seed of Abraham. So there's this veil over their faces. And then what he's saying is, only through Christ is the veil taken away. So the veils come back and the light goes on and they realize, oh, so Christ is the Messiah. And then they become Christians. Jewish nationality, former Jewish religion, then they become Christians. And so you know all through all of the epistles, the early church did struggle with this, didn't they? Because all these Gentiles were becoming Christians. The Jews said, you know, hey, we were the first Christians. And the Judaizers start telling all these Greeks, no, if you want to be a Christian, you got to be circumcised. You got to keep the Old Testament Passover. You got to eat all the right foods. And, you know, and Paul was saying, no. That was all part of the Old Covenant. Baptism has replaced circumcision. The Lord's Supper has replaced Passover. And they don't have to keep all those laws. So you know in the book of Acts, they finally have a meeting in Jerusalem. And they said, keep away from fornication with sexual immorality. Don't drink things that are strangled by blood. Okay? And we're not going to lay any other burdens. And the Gentiles thought, wow. The reason why they hung on to that one, because the Jews were taught, you know, the life is in the blood. But of course, in the sacrament, Jesus now gives us his body and blood under the bread and wine. But now, the vast majority of the church are Gentiles, like you and me. But when the veil is lifted, if you've talked to Jewish people who become Christian, they know all about when Jesus says, you cannot love father, mother, or daughter more than me. The Jews for Jesus people came to Cleveland. They had a singing group and went to my parents' church years and years ago. And my mom and dad had this young man who's from New York stay at their house overnight. And he described how his Orthodox Jewish family in New York, when he became a Christian, they disowned him. They had a gravestone in the Jewish cemetery in New York with his name on it. And when people asked about him, they said, "We have no son. Our son is dead." Okay, now that's a guy who's paying the price for being a Christian. Okay, disowned. His family says, "Oh, we don't have a son. Oh, we don't have a son." And they put his name on a gravestone. This is how serious those people were taking this. That from their perspective, if he believes in Jesus as Messiah, from their perspective, their son has apostatized, he has left the faith, and he's no more their son. So people like that, most of us have been raised in a Christian family, so it's hard for us to imagine that we have to hate father, mother, son and daughter, our only family, being rejected by our family because we're Christians. But he understands that and pays the price. And so people that go through that have a real strong grasp of how the Christian church becomes your new family, right? Because your own family has rejected you. That's the beautiful thing about being a pastor of a congregation. You know exactly how to treat everybody in this parish. The people that are your age are like your brothers and sisters. People that are younger than you are like your children. People that are older than you are like your parents. So we treat each other as family. And so for him, when he comes to the Christian church, that's now his new family because his own family rejected him. And then look at Hebrews 8, verse 9. This, beginning at verse 8, Hebrews 8 through 12, this whole section here is from Jeremiah 31 through 34, which is sometimes read during Epiphany and other times during Lent. So, verse 8, "The days are coming, declares the Lord, I will establish a new covenant with the house of Israel." Verse 10, "This is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. I will put my laws into their minds, write them on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people." This is also quoted by Peter on the day of Pentecost. "They shall not teach each one his neighbor, each one his brothers, know the Lord, for they shall all know me, from the least of them to the greatest. I will be merciful toward their iniquities, and I will remember their sins no more." And speaking of a new covenant, he makes the first one obsolete. And what is becoming obsolete and growing old is ready to vanish away. And the vanishing away, he explains in Hebrews chapter 9. This is what Elizabeth was asking before, but the old covenant. The new covenant fulfills the first, but the old is becoming obsolete. The temple in Jerusalem is gone. Okay? The Ark of the Covenant, gone. No more priests offering sacrifices. Gone. Now, true, they're still celebrating Passover in their homes, but all the stuff that was their focus, God has purposely allowed the Romans to take the whole thing down. So we realize, remember what Jesus said right before he was crucified, "Tear down this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." What was the temple of which he was speaking?
Body.
His body. Temple of his body. And so all of that is all obsolete. Now, what Luther explains, if you go down to some of the quotes here at the bottom, Seth could read for us these three paragraphs at the bottom, he's trying to explain what this whole Abrahamic covenant means to us now. You can start reading, Seth.
"Thus far, I have recounted nearly all the most powerful arguments that Paul treats in this epistle in support of the doctrine of justification. Among these, the most important and the most effective is the one he urges most, both here and in Romans, the argument about the promise. For no one can deny that the promise is not the law. Now he takes the words of the promise, 'In your offspring they shall be blessed,' etc., and carefully considers them. Then he treats times and persons, and then the offspring itself, explaining that this is Christ. Finally, he declares by means of an antithesis what the law does, namely, that it consigns one under a curse. And thus he inverts the arguments that the false apostles were using in defense of the righteousness of the law and turns them against the false apostles themselves. You are stressing the law, he says, as necessary for salvation. Have you not read that it says, he who does them shall live by them? But who does them? Therefore, as many rely on works of the law, are under a curse. Thus, where the false prophets want to conclude that righteousness and life are from the law, Paul turns their words around and concludes that the curse and death are from the law. Thus, he adequately protects and defends the doctrine of Christian righteousness by supporting it on the basis of the promise, in which he shows that the offspring of Abraham himself is Christ, with his death, resurrection, blessing, and victory over all nations. He refutes the arguments of his opponents on the basis of the words of the law, by which he says that the law is so far from justifying that it has exactly the opposite effect, namely, that it consigns men under the curse. Now there follows the conclusion of these arguments.
Which is, we'll continue, we have time on the back. Now remember, he is speaking here of what's called the second use of the law as a mirror that shows our sin. So the Ten Commandments in the law were given as the first use as a guide for society. So we have civil laws, do not kill, do not steal. The second use of the law is a mirror. We look at it and we break it all the time, so it shows our sin. Third use of the law is a guide in our Christian life. Honor others, love your parents, etc. So, when people try to take the Ten Commandments and the law and try to turn it into a bunch of rules I try to keep to save myself, he's saying they are cursed. Because if they honestly look at it, they'll say, I have had other gods, I have taken God's name in vain, I have neglected the Sabbath day, I have dishonored authority, I have hated other people, I have lusted, I have stolen, I have been discontent, and I have lied about other people. So it's like, okay, you want to be saved by the law? You got to keep the Ten Commandments perfectly. And then you look at it and go, whoa, I've broken them all. So then the law becomes a mirror and it realizes I am cursed because I've not kept it. So Paul's argument is Christ came and gives us the promise of salvation by the promise, I believe in Christ and his righteousness is credited to my account because he kept the law for me. If you reject Christ and just stick with the law, he says, try as you may, you're living under a curse because you can't keep them perfectly. Okay? So this is why when some of these evangelical groups, you know, knock on people's doors and talk to them about how, you know, if you died, if you would go to heaven, 9 out of 10 people, because people are oblivious to spiritual matters today, well, I should go to heaven. Well, I tried to be a good person and I tried to keep the Ten Commandments. And it just, this is the foolishness, the blindness of the world, not really knowing Christ and thinking, well, I guess there's a God up there, and I guess when I die, they'll say, well, you know, I tried to be a good person. I mean, this is complete spiritual blindness, isn't it? Because they will be condemned. All their sins are upon him, upon them. And so on the back, which actually is talking about the inheritance that comes by a promise, what we can do, at least at the very least before we close, and we're going to leave everything, we leave everything up, of course, for the roast. Don't take anything down. Let's continue on the front in verse 17. This is what I mean, the law, which came 430 years afterwards. So in other words, it wasn't till around 1400 BC, 1500 BC, 430 years after Abraham, that God gave the Ten Commandments through Moses. That doesn't annul the covenant previously ratified by God. In other words, he's kind of reminding them, the promise to Abraham in his seed, we shall be blessed, which is Christ, was 430 years before people even had the Ten Commandments. So it doesn't void the promise. The promise came before the commandments. If the inheritance comes by the law, it no longer comes by a promise. God gave it to Abraham by a promise. And remember, a promise is believing the promise of God when you don't yet see the answer. Abraham believed he would have a son when he didn't yet have a son. We believe that we are going to heaven, but we cannot yet see heaven. We believe that Christ is coming again in glory, but we haven't yet seen Christ come. We are accepting the promise and having faith that the promise is true. So remember I told you before, never think that, oh, it would have been so much easier, you know, to be a Christian during the day that Jesus was alive or when Moses. No, it wouldn't. Because every person who has ever lived has to look at how God acted in the past, how he's acting in the present, and how he will act in the future. Abraham could look back to the days of Noah and Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Abraham was of the line of Shem. That's how God acted in the past. Abraham was now believing the promise, and in the future would be the promise for us. The people in the New Testament era looked at how God acted in the Old Testament. They were seeing how Jesus was acting in their lives, and now Christ will come again in glory. You and I have the benefit of seeing how God acted it both in the Old and the New Testament. He comes to us in word and sacrament, and we're waiting for the promise. Everybody who has ever lived has had to live in the faith in a promise of something you can't yet see. But it's not the nihilistic existential leap of faith, which this guy named Soren Kierkegaard taught this leap of faith in the 1800s, which was a meaninglessness, saying there's no meaning to life, everything is black and dark. His leap of faith was like going to a cliff and saying, I don't know what's going to happen, I'll just jump off. That's not Christian faith. Okay, that's existentialism. Faith is based upon hear how he has acted in the past in history. He's acting in word and sacrament now, so I have plenty of evidence why I can trust the promise. So we have plenty of evidence. So our faith is not like, I hope Jesus is coming again. You know, no. You have the whole Old and New Testament. Water and word came to you when you were baptized. You went up and took Christ's body and blood, or you will, in Holy Communion. That's your evidence right there. And we accept the promise that's coming. So we'll close with that. We'll pick it up here next week. And join us for the roast. And let's close with the benediction. The grace of the Lord Jesus Christ and the love of God and the communion of the Holy Spirit be with you always. Amen.